CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 171 with Dr. Laura Perryman. The Dry Eye Master is going to make it easy if we remember to look, lift, push, and pull. This is going to be fun.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today, I've got a very special guest who is much smarter than me and is going to educate me about all things dry eye, ocular service, all the stuff that I actually don't really know. And that is Dr. Laura Perryman. Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much. This is so cool. Like, I'm a super fan, and it's a huge honor and privilege to be here with you tonight.
Oh, you're too kind. But I really enjoyed a lot of your lectures that you've given at national meetings.
Oh, thanks.
And you really bring an expertise about a topic that, you know what, they taught me almost nothing about in residency.
Right. Same. Like, I didn't learn this stuff in residency.
So how are you picking up all this stuff? Because, you know, and the more I realize with patients, and oftentimes it's from patients being a little disappointed because I'm too focused on intraocular optics. But then I'm so dumb, I forget that, like, the first thing that refracts light is the tear film, the air-water interface, the difference in refractive index. Hello? That's right. Optics 101.
That's OCAP stuff, baby.
Yeah.
Remember those days?
Luckily, they're far behind us. I don't know about that ever again.
PTSD trigger there? I don't know.
But obviously, I mean, when it comes to, if we're refractive surgeons, refractive cataract surgeons, refractive corneal surgeons, you know, you really have to pay attention to that first refracting surface, which is the ocular surface of the tear film.
I totally agree with you. You know, it's interesting how much has changed. Like, I'm vintage, shall we say, seasoned. I was trained a long time ago. And back in the day, we didn't even have restasis yet. So that totally dates me of where we're at. And I didn't really, I mean, I kind of knew dry eye was a problem, but all we really had were plugs and hypoosmolar tears and erythromycin ointment. That's kind of all we had. And it was underwhelming at best, right? And I remember, you know, as a fellow in particular, did a cornea refractive fellowship with Steve Wilson, and he was such an incredible mentor. But I remember going into LASIK surgery one day, we had a whole bunch of faces lined up, and this woman comes in with full makeup on. And even though we'd given instructions not to wear makeup on the day of your LASIK surgery, and by golly, do we have to work hard to get all that off. And even despite all that effort, removing all that schmutz and crumbs and pigment and all that stuff, some of the stuff still got into the LASIK flap interface. And so that's sort of, I'm like, oh, so what we put around our eyes matters. It gets into the tear film. So that's going to matter. And it's going to affect our surgeries. And then also when I was a fellow, I remember I finally got to do my solo cataract case all by myself. Okay. And I, you know, carefully picked my patient. Things went great. I was nervous as a French tartan church. I was like so nervous about it, but it went great. Surgery was awesome. Patient was 20/20, unhappy. I'm like, but the surgery went great. And that sort of, maybe it's the tear film. Maybe it's dry eye disease. Is this what they mean by dry eye? This is what they mean by dry eye. So I kind of come at dry eye by the school of hard knocks, but I'm also a super nerd. So I love continuing to learn. Like, and this field is expanding and growing, and it's so wickedly interesting. So I'm delighted that you're interested in this and asking questions.
Well, I think any ophthalmologist, especially if you like cataract coach, you like cataract surgery, you like cataract surgery is refractive surgery, your visual outcomes are dependent on the tear film as much as I hate to admit it.
Yes. And as a dry eye referral center, like all we do is treat ocular surface disease. That's all we do. I see beautiful cataract surgery, beautiful refractive surgery, but the surface was ignored. Even beautiful oculoplastic surgery. But the surface was ignored. And the patients have complications and their vision is compromised. So this is an area where I think there's a lot of rich exploration to be done. But also I want to encourage our colleagues that it doesn't have to be as hard as it seems to do a good job with ocular surface disease.
I mean, one of the challenges for someone who's like me, far more surgical, not so good in the clinic, it's that it's a whole spectrum of ocular surface disease. Yeah. And such as dry eye, we'll get into like meibomian gland disease, we get into blepharitis, and gosh, we know all the patients that come into all the scurf there. And then you've got like, it's a whole spectrum of things that sometimes can be a little confusing. How do we break this down to make it simpler?
I'm so glad you asked that. You know, I think the ASCRS preoperative dry eye treatment algorithm guidelines, there was two versions. They just released their second one. This is a huge effort, group effort by some of our dear colleagues and leaders at ASCRS. Chris Starr leads the effort. They've done a brilliant job of trying to distill it down into an approachable, non-overwhelming approach to dry eye disease for the cataract surgeon that speaks your language, right? So ocular surface disease has its own language. Cornea doctors have their own language. But to a cataract surgeon, I need to use your language to convey these quick things you can do to identify potential pitfalls when you're talking about surface optimization before cataract surgery. And it can be really kind of simple. Are the measurements repeatable? Is there debris in the tear film? Is the tear film stable? Is there, and I love their algorithm of LLPP. Everybody calls me LP. That's a different LP. Like, this is an LLPP. Look, lift, push, and pull. And you're looking for lid malpositions, you know, collarettes, the pathognomonic sign for Demodex blepharitis. You're looking for laxity of the lids, meibomian gland dysfunction, chronic allergic keratoconjunctivitis, all of these different things that can thwart your best efforts, right?
I like that. You know, I haven't heard that before. So look,
Yeah,
lift,
look,
push, pull.
lift. So looking from things like SLK and superior or anterior Batson membrane dystrophy, right? That can mess up your IOL calculations. Push on the meibomian glands. I use a little cotton tip wooden Q-tip to push, and I judge the assessment of the glands of what comes out of there. And then pull. You're looking for lid malpositions, lateral canthal weakness. Those things contribute to MGD. We know MGD gets worse after cataract surgery, so stay ahead of the game and cut it off at the headwaters. So look, lift, push, pull. And you're doing nanoseconds at the slit lamp anyway. So it takes only a second to do this.
LLPP. That makes a lot of that's
Look,
easy to
lift,
remember.
push, pull, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
that makes a lot of sense here. Yeah, because it's so multifactorial, right?
Yeah. But it's just a quick screening exam to identify things that could derail your efforts. And honestly, when you do just that bare minimum and you just treat it directly, like simple, easy things to treat, what we'll get into, you might be able to convert a non-premium candidate into a premium candidate just by paying attention to the surface and getting it as happy and healthy as possible. I tell patients, cataract surgery is like putting a wedding ring on the rest of your lifetime vision. You need to prepare for the big day.
That's true. And I used to teach residents, and when I taught them, I would say, remember, when you do a cataract surgery, you own that patient for life, and that patient owns you for life.
Hopefully you're not hovering over a barrel somehow.
Listen, I got one foot on a banana peel, the other foot in the grave. Believe me, I'm thin
I
ice
think
here.
you're mostly on a pedestal, my dear.
No, but I think these are all super, super important things because obviously we can deliver a better outcome if we pay more attention to that. I saw a guy this week where, and you could tell before he even the slit lamp, he's an old guy. He's a widower. He puts on his paper, puts this on his paperwork. His eyebrows are like so out of control. They're like two big bushes growing on his forehead. And then you look at his eyes in the slit lamp, and all I can see is all the lashes matted and glued together with crusty MGD, blepharitis. I mean, forget
Probable
Demodex.
Demodex, right? That's the only two.
I saw like squirrels in his eyelashes. I mean, it was crazy.
Oh, and you don't want to go cooking in the bathroom. You want to cook in a clean kitchen, right?
Right. Then I was like, listen, we can't do your surgery. I know he's got like brunettes and cataracts. He is literally 2200. And he thinks I'm a crazy man when I'm like, no, I can't do your surgery yet. You have to first fix this issue.
Yeah. Well, good for you. Was
It
he
was,
mad at you or did you feel good about it?
well, no, I felt very good about it. I felt so bad for the poor guy that I actually, like, the only way that I found to get the gunky stuff off his caked together eyelashes was to glue him up with your favorite erythromycin ointment they taught me 30 years ago at residency. And that just that ointment glue, just was able to like loosen up all the gunky stuff. And I sat there for 10 minutes with a Q-tip scraping all that crap off his eyelids.
Amazing.
I tell you, after the scrape of his eyelids, I bet you he lost a pound.
Right? I tell patients with blepharitis, it's like there was so much junk on there, your eyelids have lost weight. Time for a hot girl summer, right?
But no, I think now I've got him buffing up his ocular surface. We're going to check him back in a month. And you could tell right away, too, because I look at his biometry. Like his keratometry was like patchy. His topography looked ugly. The rings were nothing matched. If you look at the Galilei case, the topography case, the Lenstar Iowa Master case, they're all different.
Yeah,
Oh,
caution,
we're really just
caution.
guessing then. It's just we're just guessing.
Yes, that right. And we don't like to guess, we like to know. Like we're all type A. We like to know what we're getting into. So
Right.
did his topography change at all after
I just saw him last
he
week.
gunked his lids?
So I just saw him last week. I degunked all his lids. I gave him some of these. I put him on a very strong, huge regimen of treatment. I'm going to see him back in a month and remeasure. It's what you said earlier, actually. Is it repeatable? Are the measurements repeatable?
Right.
That's really, they don't teach that in residency.
Measure
If you're a
twice,
young
cut once.
ophthalmologist, if you're a young ophthalmologist listening, you better take notes. They don't teach you this in residency.
That's right. Measure twice and cut once.
Right? So I also have other challenges. And so everyone in the country, depending where you are in the US or internationally, you'll have your own challenges. My challenges in Los Angeles, especially in where I am, Beverly Hills, it's very dry. There's no humidity.
Right.
We love that in the summer because it's 10% humidity, but it means your eyes are super dry too. The other
Totally.
thing is, we have such aggressive plastic surgery. We have eyelid surgery. Blepharoplasty is done by non-oculoplastic people. And these patients, they have lagophthalmos, like frankly.
Ouch.
It's like we got challenges.
Those are big challenges. I want to dovetail onto that if we have a moment. I agree with you that a poorly done oculoplastic surgery, or even a well done oculoplastic surgery in the context of these untreated conditions, can lead to leg ophthalmos, right? And
Right.
there's a couple of tells. Like I've gotten really good at like spotting blephs from across the room
Okay.
because there's this little telltale sign. The lateral third of the lid is just slightly lower than it should. It's a subtle little malposition where it's too low. And if you test the strength of the orbicularis muscle in that area, it's very weak. And we can strengthen that with physical therapy of sorts with radiofrequency and dynamic muscle stimulation. It's like a personal trainer for your eyelids. You warm up the muscle, and then the electrical impulse strengthens it and works it out, retrains it how to be active again, how to do a proper blink. Because it turns out the muscle of Réolon, that little bit of orbicularis muscle fiber that wraps around the necks of the meibomian gland terminal ductules, that only activates and squeezes at the end of a complete blink. So if you're short-sheeted the bed after oculoplastic surgery, you're never getting that pump action of meibom, and all you're going to get is back pressure and stasis and constipation of the meibom. So look for those lid malpositions, but you can treat it. We have data we're going to be presenting next year on improvements in leg ophthalmos and in complete blinking in post-blepharoplasty patients with this technology. It's really cool.
Wow. And then if you're a patient by chance,
Pardon?
if you're a patient by chance listening to this, which is this podcast is 99% ophthalmology, but if you're a patient, do not go to the general plastics guy or gal for your eye surgery. Go to an oculoplastics person only.
Right. Much less likely to short sheet the bed.
Right.
But there's an
Now you
important
see
step in there.
that. I do see that. The lateral third of the
It
lower
just,
lid
it's so
is
subtle.
probably,
It's just a little too
yeah.
low. Yep. And so what I'll do is at the slit lamp, I'll say, go ahead and close your eyes. And if you see that upper lid like struggling to stay closed, I call that
Yeah.
the jumping orbicularis sign. That paper thin muscle is trying so hard to close and keep that eye protected during sleep. It can't do it. And it certainly can't blink properly. Then what I'll do is I'll have the patient squeeze as hard as they can, and I forcibly open. And invariably, that section that is low slung like that is very weak. And that's a target for the Optulift platform, the RF and deep muscle stimulation.
Well, let's talk about the rest of the US, not the crazy people in Beverly Hills, which is my neck of the woods.
There's crazy people up here too.
I know. But let's talk about the country as a whole. In general, though, what's the most common issue we're going to see in a 70-plus year old cataract surgery patient in regards to ocular surface?
I
What's the
think
most
the
common?
most common thing you're going to see is Demodex blepharitis.
Wow.
I think that's the most common thing you're going to see. In fact, we have data showing about 60% of cataract patients have evidence of collarettes, evidence of Demodex blepharitis. That's pretty high odds, right? I'd go fishing on those odds. I'd go to Vegas on those odds.
Wow.
And
60.
then say about 60%, it's higher in contact lens intolerant patients, estimated to be around 93%. So that has implications for our LASIK patients, right? For refractive surgery patients.
Right, they're seeing you because now they're like 36 and they just the contacts, I just can't wear more than a few hours. My eyes feel so irritated. I can't tolerate contacts anymore. Now I need LASIK.
That's right. And scrubs ain't going to do it because those little eight-legged micro parasites, they burrow into the lash follicle. And there's a smaller cousin, Demodex brevis, that lives inside the meibomian glands. So they have to be, you have to kill them. And you do that through lotilaner or XDEMVY.
Well, yeah.
Yep. And then the second most common condition, I would say, in that older demographic is untreated skin conditions. I feel like I've become
You like
part of
rosacea?
Yeah, things like rosacea, untreated rosacea, seborrhea, I think is a big problem as well. I think that seborrhea is a component of about 15% of my chronic MGD patients.
Okay.
And that needs to be treated as well. We treat it with topical ketoconazole 2% shampoo, massage it into the scalp. It's a scalp treatment. Let it sit for 2 minutes, take some of the lather, do your brows, take some of that lather carefully, paint your eyelash base with it. Take some of it and make sure you get your beard real good if you have a beard. I'm not judging who does and who doesn't. Let it sit on there for a good 2 minutes before rinsing it off twice a week. That can takes about 8 weeks to notice an impact, but that can debulk the Malassezia furfur, the fungal load that contributes to inflammation in the skin. The organism Malassezia furfur has lipases, which breaks down host oils into free fatty acids. So you'll see this as saponification of the lid margin after you do
Yeah,
your diagnostic meibomian gland expression.
it's like foamy.
Yes, those are lipases, and there's only a few organisms that make it. You have Staph, strep, P. acnes, it has a new name now, I forget what they call it now, and Bacillus aureus, the gut organism of Demodex, and seborrhea or Malassezia furfur. Those are the things that cause saponification of the lid margin. And those need to be treated. Like those soap bubbles are going to break down your oil layer of your tear film and contribute to tear film instability, contributes to evaporative stress, contributes to the inflammation load on the ocular surface, and round and round the hamster wheel of misery we go.
I have a confession.
Tell me.
In the last 30 years of ophthalmology, and God knows how many tens of thousands of patients, maybe 100,000 patients, I've never once checked the scalp for dandruff.
You haven't? How about the brows? Do
Well,
you
that's how
browse out of
sure
the
I get to
sun?
the brows, but I never. You mean I got to start checking people's scalps
No,
now?
not at all. Not at all. Not no, 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 no. But definitely look at the lashes, look for
Right.
saponification, and then just look at the brows for that scaly, crusty stuff.
Yeah, the brows, especially old men.
Yes.
I'm getting there now. I mean, here's my public confession. I gotta trim my eyebrows, otherwise I look like a crazy person. They're like growing out like this.
Gonna stop using the Latisse on your brows, man. That's problem
I
solved.
wish I play. I wish I had teeth. I got nothing. I'm not using any of that stuff. But it's just like,
I'm
no,
joking.
just there's something that happens with age, I tell you.
Yep.
My hair migrates from my scalp, it's migrated to my back. So I guess I was saying earlier, I got a sweater now I'm wearing. But besides that, like the eyebrows, I used to have such beautiful, like thick, pretty eyebrows. But now when the gray hairs come in, they grow like crazy in like 3D. And like if I don't have my barber trim, when I get a haircut, always get them trimmed. Otherwise, I look crazy.
Well, that's okay. Trim them away. Trim away. I don't know. I don't necessarily think you have seborrhea.
Yo, so far so good.
There's another pearl I want to share with you
Tell me.
for that rapid fire busy ophthalmologist, right?
Yep.
So we talked about the look, lift, push, pull. Look for saponification on the lid margin about 60 seconds after you've actually pushed on the meibomian glands. But when you go from the right eye to the left eye, take the side arm of your slit lamp and turn it 45 degrees with a light diffuser on, and just go slowly across the bridge of the nose. Not like really slowly because you're busy, but like just stop on the other side of on the left side of the nose
Okay.
where the light hits. You'll see it illuminate, and you're looking under the binoculars where the light hits the fine vellus hairs of the face. They're very, very delicate, very fine. You'll see those, but the coarse, stubby ones that are sticking out. Those are Demodex collarettes of the skin. So just because you're not seeing it on the lashes, If you see other signs of Demodex blepharitis, telangiectasias, lid margin erythema, thickness of the eyelids, meibomian gland dysfunction, other signs of Demodex blepharitis, look at the nose. We call it the alpenglow sign, and the correlation, we're working on a manuscript for finding Demodex in the epilated lashes, irrespective of color ads. If you see the alpenglow sign, 0.83%. So it's like ultra fast, moving from right eye to left eye, just looking across the bridge of the nose for that alpenglow sign, the light that hits the peaks of the projections. And that is an indicator that you have a probable Demodex blepharitis, and you can get things better in 6 weeks. It's crazy. That's the closest thing to a silver bullet we have in ocular surface disease is low telangiectasias.
I never even thought, no one ever taught me.
Well,
I never even thought to look between the eyes. I never thought of it.
Yeah. Just right on that bridge of the nose, right on the left side. As you cross.
People right now are taking notes saying, cataract coach, dumber than a bucket of rocks. Okay, gotcha. He never looks.
Hardly.
I see your point now. Like, they're just such little kind of signals.
You can pick up so fast. Like, you're busy. The next patient you got to get onto. These add seconds, like maybe 2 seconds onto your exam. You got your scribe, positive alpenglow sign, positive collarettes. And then that will trigger that'll trigger the treatment.
Well, I mean, we're so focused on doing our special little subspecialty that sometimes we forget, like, there's like a whole patient there. There's like a whole body there. It's not just two eyeballs.
Yeah. Eyeballs need a heart and a brain.
Well, I mean, just all the little things. I mean, obviously you said, looking at the eyebrows, looking at the hair, scalp line or the face where they have like rosacea, looking between the two eyes as you go. You kind of have to remind yourself of this.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, I had a friend who's a primary care doctor, and I was talking to him recently, and he sent me a patient with some retina problems. I said, I don't do retina. I told him. And he's like, what do you mean? Eyes are like two things the size of walnuts. What do you mean you don't do the whole eyeball? What are you, lazy? I'm like, no, you kind of don't get it. There are doctors who specialize in just the retina. Do you mean, he says, there are ophthalmologists who specialize in a few cell layers? I'm like, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is why all my primary care friends say, ophthalmologist, you're all crazy. You're all crazy. Because can you imagine? We divide up such a small organ, which is what we do.
That's what we do. That's right.
But I like your input there, really actually looking at the patient as a whole and kind of getting a big picture. That makes a ton of sense, but it's not something I've actually routinely done.
Yeah. Especially if you're really in that mindset of what can I do to set this patient up for success and nail that refractive outcome and make them 20/20 gleeful happy. Not unhappy, gleefully happy. I think it involves treating the eyelids before you proceed with surgery.
Now let's talk about, we have a whole spectrum of treatment options. You mentioned one silver bullet here, XDEMV for the Demodex, but we've got like a spectrum of different types of tears for the ocular surface. We've got new FDA approved drugs. We've got cyclosporine. Mm-hmm. We've got lefitograss. We've got, what's this one? The perfluorohexyl octane.
You got it. Yes.
That's like a mouthful. You know what? That's surprisingly a good addition to our spectrum.
Indeed. Indeed. So instead of waiting for weeks and weeks for the meibomian glands to improve their function and their quality, you can support those meibomian glands while you're working hard to get them in a healthier spot.
So how do we incorporate perfluorohexyl octane? It sounds like something I put in my gas tank to help my fuel injector look better, by the way.
It does.
But how do I incorporate perfluorohexyl octane in my practice?
So I think anytime you see tear film instability and meibomian gland dysfunction, like a low tear breakup time measured with your fluorescein strip, mm-hmm. not a drop of fluoresce, that will mask an abnormal tear breakup time because it's too much volume, right? So I wouldn't base it on that. Anytime you see MGD and evaporative load, then you should think about supporting the surface with perfluorohexyl octane. And you can use it 2 to 4 times a day. We study it 4 times a day in the FDA trials, but I do flexible dosing based off of the patient's symptom index. And I like to put it in after a high quality preservative-free artificial tear. And there's varying degrees of tears with varying degrees of hyaluronic acid, which is great and helps to moisturize those epithelial cells that are struggling to survive, you can see some improvements in staining with artificial tears. So I like to put that on first. I tell my patients the mantra is volumize, moisturize, and protect. We're putting Saran Wrap on the fruit salad. It's not quite true because it's not totally occlusive, but that's essentially what it is.
Perfluorhexyloctane is to kind of lock it in.
Yeah, just to protect it from evaporating so quick. It's an anti-evaporative and it reduces friction. So I use it routinely in my conjunctival chalasis patients.
Interesting. You know, I travel a lot to lecture, like a lot, like 20 countries a year.
Amazing.
And last week I was in Ireland, week before I was in Spain. And do you know, in Spain, I saw in the drugstore, over the counter, for 14 euros, a drop called Evo Tears. And I was like, what is this? And it was perfluorohexyloctane. Over the counter for 14 euros, which is like, I don't know, $17.
Yeah. It's a regulatory thing, right?
And then so I had a patient here in the U.S. who said, doctor, you prescribed this to me. It's $1,000 a bottle. Like, how are we stuck in this situation in America where it's $1,000 a bottle for us to get it here, but I could buy it for $17 in Spain?
Right. So to answer, yes, I agree with you. It seems a little wonky, but if you look into some of the reasons why, comes down to an FDA regulatory issue. So abroad, it's considered classified as an OTC. But here, they went through the FDA process of safety and efficacy testing in order to bring it to market. And with that comes a lot of investment, right? They need to recoup their investment somehow to bring it to market. And frankly, I think you need to look at the PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers. They're these sneaky backroom guys that skim a heck of a lot off of that.
Cost of goods. Beyond my brain to understand all that.
Yeah, it's a pretty dark, insidious underworld for sure, the PBMs. And then you put vertical integration on top of that. And what could possibly go wrong? I don't know. I'm being totally sarcastic. But do you remember the days of Mountain Bell when it was disassembled and was broken apart because of monopolization?
Oh, Ma Bell.
Do you remember those days?
Yeah, well, there was one phone company for the whole country.
Our younger ones aren't going to remember this, but I remember when that was broken up on RICO anti-racketeering, anti-monopoly things. And so I don't know how we got to this day and age where big entities like CVS and Aetna can do vertical integration where they own every piece of the puzzle. How is that not monopolization?
Well, you got to be like, patients were smart. I had a patient. She told me, she says, she orders it, the Evo Tears from Europe, buys it in bulk for $17 a bottle, pays like $50 in shipping, pays whatever import duties and tariffs. And she's like, yeah, it ends up costing like $25 a bottle, instead of
$1,000. If you can get it past customs, get it past customs. So customs is really cracking down on that because it's a drug here and they don't want unapproved products coming in when it's a drug here in the U.S.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's funny, a similar regard, my European colleagues, when I was in Ireland or Spain, like, yeah, when we come to the U.S., they buy melatonin. It's like, why? Because in their country, melatonin you can't get, but in the U.S., it's over the counter.
Interesting. Because it's considered a drug abroad, or why is that?
I guess they just can't get it, they said. So they just buy in the U.S., which is over the counter. I've actually never even tried melatonin. I've got no problem falling asleep. I can fall asleep right now.
You work pretty hard, my friend.
Yeah. Depends who you ask.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the whole spectrum then. So we've got, how do I differentiate various tiers? So patients, I'm going to ask me, do I use this tiers, the other tiers, which brand of tiers? What are the differences? Do I do a thicker one? Do I do a gel one? When do I go to an ointment at night? How do I use this? Make it simple for a guy like me who's not that bright.
I can make it super simple.
Okay.
Try them until you find one you like.
So that's like the toothbrush.
That's the pithy answer. But honestly, I have tried for years to try to predict which drop a patient's going to love the most. It's trial and error. I would say reach for a branded product. There's been a couple of very serious sterility problems with off-label, recalls, very serious blinding infections from products made abroad that were not branded, not well controlled. So I think as long as you're picking a branded good name product, that is a step number one. And then step number two is typically we have samples at our office. Try a variety. Pick one that's got a higher HA concentration. If you have a contact lens, where maybe pick a preservative-free high concentration like Hylo Forte. Like, just it's very much trial and error. And as far as the nighttime ointment thing goes, I'll be honest, if somebody is using nighttime ointment, there's a problem that I need to uncover and fix. Yes, that ointment is helpful, but outside of severe scarring circumstances or ocular graft versus host disease, I want to hunt down the reason for that nighttime dryness requiring an ointment.
Yeah, well, in my neck of the woods, it's because an overly aggressive bleph.
Yes, which we talked about how to rehabilitate it and how to get it better. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, for sure. No, that's obviously a very big issue here. Yeah, that's funny. I tell patients, they ask me the tears, and my standard answer is, I said, it's like toothpaste. Crest, Colgate, and Agfresh, they're all pretty good. Just choose the one that works best for you.
Ding, ding. Yeah. As much as I do this all day, every day, I say the same thing. Just try them until you find one that you like.
Right.
Preservative-free, I think, is good, but just because something does not say preservative-free doesn't mean that it's not okay to use. So, for example, Refresh Reliva is preserved with Sofzia, a non-BAK version preservative, right. And that one's okay, right?
Try whatever works for you. I mean,
yeah. Just make sure it's a branded product.
And then when do you start bringing in cyclosporin? And the cyclosporins, which now there are multiple different versions of cyclosporin. And then also, when do you bring in lifitegrast? So where does this all fit into the equation?
I'm so glad you asked. So our mutual friend and colleague, excellent clinician scientist, John Hovhaniesian, has done a series of really important work looking at treating inflammation in the perioperative dry eye patient. And he's looked at it for cataract surgery and prior to refractive surgery. And he's looked at the traditional cyclosporin 0.05 emulsion, the micellar 0.09 formulation of cyclosporin. And he's also looked at lifitegrast. And the good news is, if you start 28 days before the surgery, you get significant improvements in refractive outcomes, patient satisfaction scores, OSDI scores, just by starting 28 days ahead. So I think the upshot of that really important body of work is, as soon as you identify inflammation or you suspect inflammation in your perioperative patient, get started. And then 28 days prior, you can get things cleaned up enough. And then to our colleagues who were trained or conditioned to repeat, you know, cyclosporin takes too long to work, I want you to disabuse yourself of that idea, because it's simply not correct.
So when did it start working?
As early as 2 weeks. Some data is around 1 week. Cyclosporin 0.09 shows benefit at 1 week, not specifically in that perioperative study, but in another dry eye model. So I think the paradigm shift is that these drugs do work faster than you think, and it can very much enhance your cataract surgical, refractive surgical outcomes.
Yeah, because the dogma was that, no, you got to wait 6 weeks. So you're saying maybe the dogma is not dog food.
Well, so that's partially true. Steve Flugfelder did this really awesome work, gosh, probably 12 years ago. He's such a hero of mine, where he did impression cytology looking at goblet cell density in perioperative cataract patients. And what he found, this was when all we had was the cyclosporin 0.05 emulsion, that the goblet cell density starts to recover not at 4 weeks, but at 6 weeks. Mm. Now, goblet cells have this critically important immunoregulatory function. Not only do they make mucin to help the tears wet and spread, the more you have, the more you can return to homeostasis that we've disrupted with our surgical event, right? So that's probably where that 6 week idea came in. But we have data now 28 days before.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then with lifitegrast is, it can be a hero drug for some patients. It's it reminds me of cilantro. You love it or you hate it. It's for the right person, it's fabulous. I find that some of my super responders, if you will, like the people that tend to love it, are going to be people that have a seasonal allergic conjunctivitis component. It turns out that allergic conjunctivitis has an immunologic bridge to meibomian gland dysfunction. And that's through PMNs or polys, right? That's the immunologic bridge.
Okay.
The allergic event happens, eosinophils come along, polys are the immunologic bridge. They're directly linked to MGD in the allergic conjunctivitis patient. You only have three things in your toolkit to beat down the polys or the immunologic bridge. You have steroids, you have IPL or intense pulse light, and you have lifitegrast. That's it. That's all you've got. So in a patient that has a history of seasonal allergic conjunctivitis and meibomian gland dysfunction, I often will have a strong preference for lifitegrast. Can't always get it because of formulary issues, because CVS Aetna has their vertical integration model and their profit margins to preserve, whatever that is. But I do have some scientific rationale on occasion for preferring one formulation or over another. We also have data now that switching from 0.05 emulsion to 0.09 nanomicellar leads to improvements in Schirmer scores, staining, symptom indices with as early as 1 to 2 months. So that it's called it's a swap over study. And that paper just published recently.
Right. I mean, obviously these are wildly popular. I think these drugs are like multi-billion dollar a year drugs here in the US.
Because they work.
You know, I get it.
Yeah.
I really, it's now in this whole spectrum too. So we talked about those ones. When do you bring in other treatments beyond that?
So yeah, great question. My general approach is to identify all the co-conspirators of dry eye disease. It's often involving dermatologic conditions like rosacea and seborrhea. We talked about that a little bit. I'm a big user of intense pulse light for seborrhea, it does help with seborrhea as well, but mainly for rosacea and meibomian gland dysfunction. Okay. I can throw my football further downfield and getting a patient better with IPL than anything else I got in a short period of time. It's still my workhorse. Okay. But if I don't get the gains in symptom improvement that I expect or the corneal staining that I expect, I start looking for other contributors, right? Is there a neurotrophic keratitis component to this? Mm. And that's so, I'm doing a lot more corneal nerve testing with my Cachet Bonnet. I wish I had the Brill aesthesiometer to like really quantify, but I do still have a Cachet Bonnet. And we treat that with PRP, platelet-rich plasma drops. We make them in-house under sterile conditions, and that really helps to heal the keratitis and improve corneal nerve function pretty darn quickly. And it's natural.
So you're drawing their blood, and then you spin it out. I don't even know what's the process of making this.
Right, so it's really easy. You have your patient be well hydrated, and because you pull about 10 ml vials to create a supply. It's quite a bit. Yep.
Okay.
You spin it out at a certain speed and duration, and then under a sterile flow hood, under sterile instruments and sterile gloves, you pull off the platelet layer and the plasma layer, and you put it into these little dropperettes that last 1 week. Keep the supply in the freezer, pull out one per week, use it 4 times a day, and that's a 90-day supply. And then we check their staining and corneal nerve sensation at 90 days, and 95% of the time, it's significantly improved. If it's not, I'm reaching for cenegermin or Oxervate.
Wow. Like, I didn't think that after my internship or my residency, I'd have to be drawing blood again. But
it's
fun.
It's a lost skill. It's super fun to draw blood.
You feel like a doctor again, huh?
I know, right?
like a real doctor. Like, I can draw your blood, sure. Well, that's so interesting. So what a high success rate. So wow. So you'll do that before going to like Oxervate.
Yeah, mostly because it's honestly such a frustrating process to get through the prior authorization shenaniganery, right?
But expensive. Oxervate costs more than a car.
Great medicine when we need it, when a patient gets it, it works. But it's just a big challenge with the prescription and prior authorization thing.
Well, because like I said, it costs as much as a car, like a really nice car, not a cheap, not like the 11-year-old junk box I'm driving. It's like a new car. Wow.
Yeah, it's very expensive. So PRP is more affordable than that. We have great success with it. Other reasons for that patient not feeling significantly better is conjunctival cholasis.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So this is really interesting to me. The conjunctiva has type 2 collagen adherence to Tenon's capsule and the deeper structures of the eye. With chronic inflammation, MMP9s clip those collagen attaching fibers, and the conjunctiva rumples up like a bed sheet, right? We treat it, and I haven't found a rosacea patient yet who doesn't have CCH, right? It just goes with the territory, chronic inflammation. We approach it pharmacologically with brimonidine. Melissa Toyos presented this really cool body of work in 2019 at ASCRS, where she looked at OCT measurements of conjunctival folds, lip cough, lid parallel conjunctival folds is what they called it. And they showed significant reductions with over-the-counter brimonidine. And so that's my first.
OTC brimonidine, wow, the low dose one.
Which has a lower, much lower rate of allergenicity than the glaucoma dosed brimonidine. So that's good news if you're worried about that, much lower risk of that allergenicity that's notorious with higher dose brimonidine. Yes, we treat it with artificial tear and a little drop of the over-the-counter brimonidine or Lumify, and remeasure under fluorescein the conjunctival folds and show the patient, look how much better, smoother these folds are. And they say, oh yeah, my eye feels better too. I like to do just one eye at a time. And then ask the patient 60 seconds later, do you notice a difference? I was like, oh yeah, this one's jealous. Like, can we catch the other one up? I'm like, yeah, great. That CCH is part of your symptom index. And then if that's not enough over time, I wait until after cataract surgery is all done because I know CCH gets worse after cataract surgery. But after that's all done and that simple pharmacologic approach is no longer sufficient, artificial tear, Lumify, and a little bit of perfluorhexyloctane, then I'll proceed with something called a plasma pen conjunctivoplasty. Takes me 2 minutes to do with a slit lamp. It's plasma is the fourth state of matter. It's non-contact, non-incisional, minimally invasive, and it just shrinks the folds in real time and allows that conjunctiva to.
Where do you get a plasma pen from? I don't even.
Plasma pen. I can hook you up with the vendor. I can tell you how where to get one. But yeah, it's such an easy.
Basically, you go like in the, what's that, the inferior fornix, and then just do a few spots.
Well, kind of. What I've discovered along the way is that CCH is a 360-degree disease. And what taught me the lesson is I had this patient with bad SLK, like 3 to 4+ staining and miserable. And he's super grumpy every time he comes in. Every time, everything I tried to do, it's like he was kind of better, but not really, and still florid staining. Well, his CCH was so bad that it kept sneaking up under his scleral lens. And I'm like, I do not want that to ulcerate over a weekend, strangulate and ulcerate. It kept sneaking up under there. So I'm like, we got to fix this. And all I did was the inferior section. I did three concentric rings, avoiding the limbus, of course, by a good 3 millimeters down into the fornix. And by golly, his superior SLK resolved. And I'm like, oh, it's a 360-degree problem. So now I do treat upper and lower to get that shrinking and improved draping. I can even restore the tear reservoir, the inferior tear reservoir, which is short in a lot of these CCH patients with the plasma pen technology.
So interesting. And then when do you need to do a surgical conjunctival like excision?
Oh, Monty, this trip to the OR.
When do you need to do that?
Level four CCH, where it's like muffin topping over the edge of the lid margin. That needs the OR and amniotic membranes and all that good stuff. But short of that, I can manage it with a 2-minute procedure at the slit lamp.
And you're just doing like topical tetracaine or something?
Yeah, so I trim Wexel sponges and put them, soak them with proparacaine, a little bit of brimonidine for vasoconstriction, and a combination antibiotic steroid. So I soak them with that, put one in the inferior fornix and one in the superior fornix, let it sit for a minute or two while I'm finishing my setup, take it out with a non-toothed forceps, and then go to town with my plasma pen,
Interesting.
send them out with the antibiotic steroid drops for maintenance, an artificial tear, perfluorhexyloctane to promote healing, reduce friction on that healing folds, Tylenol for discomfort. And by day three, patients are like, hey, doc, when are we doing the other eye?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That makes a it makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah. And it's an orphan disease, in my humble opinion. Like, CCH is the ugly redheaded stepchild of ocular surface disease. Nobody wants to do it. And so I found that this technique has been really a great, approachable, easy to do approach for bridging this unmet need, this particular unmet need.
No, I think it
I've got
makes.
lots of videos on my Instagram. I'm Dry Eye Master on Instagram. I've got
Well,
videos on how to do that.
whatever links you give me, we'll put here in the description.
Cool.
So we're happy to share that with the whole audience here.
Cool.
But no, I think we're, oh, I think, listen, we're all here to learn.
Exactly. Which makes it so much fun.
Well, that's the fun part of this is like, you know, I'm doing a lot of learning and you're doing a lot of teaching.
I'm glad you're having fun. I'm impressed that you're interested in dry eye disease. So thank you for your
I think we all have to be.
Because on some level, for sure.
You have to be because if you do anything cataract refractive, your patients have to have a good ocular surface. Otherwise, they're not going to see well. If you're even like any other ophthalmologist, it's again, it's a hugely important part because patients say, well, my eyes feel like this feel. And we're not used to dealing with feel.
Yeah.
We're used to dealing with see.
Yeah.
This is dealing with feel now.
Yep.
And even retina docs who tend to refract patients with the light system in the wall, better one or two, on or off. Even they tend to like, okay, they have to like do know something about this.
Yeah, they do. And you know what? Some retina docs actually get the connection between ocular surface disease and their patient's well-being. I've had so many retina docs say, you know what, LP? When I clean up the ocular surface, we get much fewer callbacks to the office after their injections, their VEGF injections.
Right.
Because the ocular surface can sustain the assault just a little bit better. And patients are more comfortable, which makes your staff happy. That's probably another good reason to pay attention. Yeah, no, for sure.
Well, that's another huge issue. Because in the U.S., yeah, we're doing 4 million cataracts a year, maybe 600,000 to 700,000 LASIK a year. But we're also doing like 10, 12 million intravitreal injections a year. That's like the biggest by far.
I had not heard that. That's crazy. That's amazing. And 35 million Americans have dry eye. So it dwarfs all of it.
You know, it's so funny, though. It's like we say now, okay, yeah, 10% of the U.S. population has dry eye disease. But 30 years ago, when I was like in med school starting residency, this was like never even brought up. It's like at that point, it must have been like less than 1% of people, or at least so we thought.
Truly. And even worse, we called it a postmenopausal woman's disease back when I trained, and that never sat well with me. I'm like, well, how come I'm seeing this young man in front of my in my chair with bad dry eye disease? Like, don't emasculate your patient by calling it a postmenopausal woman's disease. And it really is equal opportunity, and we're seeing it in younger and younger people. Who knows how much screen time has to do with it? Maybe some. Probably goes back to that incomplete blinking problem, right? You gotta blink all the way to get that muscle realign to do its thing.
I mean, I hate to admit, but when I'm on my Insta, I probably hardly blink at all. I'm just like glued to it.
Yeah, gotta blink.
I mean, that it's gotta be an issue because the amount of screen time now that people have, especially the younger generations, I mean, these are hours a day.
Hours a day. Yeah, it's not good.
That's crazy.
And it's how I relax at night. Some guilty confession on my part. It's like when I get home, I just want to chill. And doom scroll.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is like they figured out like how to tap into the human psyche and like what will keep you addicted maximally and like
We're being manipulated. It's about like being in Vegas. I know I'm being manipulated, but I kind of like it. Not really. I'm joking. I don't like it at all.
You know what I tend to do? I actually learned from this. I tend to what I call post and ghost. I post something that's
post and ghost.
I post something every day, right? So there's a new cataract coach video every day. We're almost at video number 3,000 days in a row. And
that's impressive.
Wherever I put on Instagram, I tend not to come back and read all the comments. It's just like, I don't have time for that. I just don't.
So do you do it first thing in the morning? Because I do Wordle first thing in the morning. Like, when do you do this?
So cataract coach is automated. So
okay.
The next, I can die tomorrow and the next month's worth of videos will automatically post. So I try to keep at least 1 month of videos in the queue. And so it posts every day at 2 a.m. West Coast time here in the U.S. Because my biggest market for cataract coaches USA is number one, India's two, Brazil's three. So I want USA very first. Cool. So I want 5 a.m. East Coast people to wake up. If you're on the East Coast, when you wake up at 5 a.m., boom, the cataract coach post is already there. And so at 5 a.m., it posts to cataractcoach.com, to YouTube, to Instagram, to Facebook, to LinkedIn, and it sends out the daily cataract coach email all at 5 a.m. East Coast time or 2 a.m. Pacific time.
That's impressive.
It's just the only way to do it is to automate it. And that way I can actually travel and I can actually have a life. Mm-hmm. I don't have to like think about wake. So no, I actually do not wake up at 2 a.m. to post that. It's automated.
That's awesome. That's
and you awesome. Look, every it's exactly 2:00 a.m. It's not 2:01.
Love it, love it, love it. So on a leap year, will it remember like daylight savings? No problem. It calculates that.
It figures. Who knows? It figures it all out. But like I'm one of the guys, I actually need a good 7 hours, 8 hours of sleep. I cannot.
I need a ton of sleep. It's so annoying. Sleep disturbance is another reason for dry eye, right? That is bidirectional. Sleep disturbance is highly associated with dry eye as well for a couple reasons. Number one, you need that restorative time, that restorative sleep.
Right.
But sleep disturbances like sleep apnea are heavily correlated with ocular surface disease. I can't tell you how many times I diagnose floppy eyelid syndrome in a patient. It goes back to that look, lift, push, pull, right?
I'm looking
for floppy lid. Jesus, like, oh my gosh, that's the lacrimal gland. Hey, yeah, it's like, that's not good. Pull that lid up more than Eisenhower's basset hounds.
Sorry for being stupid here, but how is it related to sleep apnea? I don't know.
So when you have those hypoxic episodes, it creates a hypoxic injury to the tissues, and MMP9s upregulate in the tissues. That clips the elastin fibers in the tissues, and you get that stretched out phenomenon. That was my first paper I wrote and published as a resident was on floppy eyelid syndrome. And we now have histologic evidence that it's a problem with MMP9s in the tissues. So the other damage of sleep apnea is hypoxic injury to the muscle of Reolan. So now that muscle is total punk due to hypoxic injury and hypoxic injury induced necrosis. And that muscle has lost its function to pump meibum during a blink all day long.
Golly, getting old sucks.
Well, I've diagnosed it in teeny tiny 100-pound women.
Really? Yes,
of course. Like, I'm floppy eyelid. Absolutely. Super not fair. Like, usually you think it's like an overweight former linebacker. Right. That's not necessarily true. I end up looking in a lot of oral pharynxes for the Mallampati score, looking to see if they have a nice big open airway or if it's kind of crowded back there. That's another predictor of sleep apnea.
Wow. I've been wearing this, what's this ring called? Aura ring or something.
Do you like it?
Yeah, it's a hocus pocus, and I'm kind of pissed that I'm paying $7 a month for it. Yeah, even though I bought it already, but I like what it tracks the sleep, so it tells you if you had like
you get good sleep.
Well, also measure like your oxygen stats throughout the night, so it'll tell you how much REM sleep you had, whether or not you had like episodes of lower oxygen stats. So I'm sleeping fine. There's no issue there.
That's good. There's another component of sleep disturbance that contributes to dry eye, and that's mouth breathers. So if you have a lot of sinusitis, a deviated septum, problems with your nose, and you breathe through your mouth instead, that also drops your nocturnal tear production. So it turns out that airflow across your nasal turbinates is a trigger for your basal tear production all night long. So like, again, remember when we said, if somebody's dependent on ointment at night, I'm like, something else is wrong. I need to figure out what it is, right? So I start looking for all those little clues, all those little mechanisms, those little contributors.
That makes a ton of sense now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only time I end up doing too much mouth breathing is when I try to sleep with my retainers to keep my teeth straight.
Yep.
So now I've learned I just don't sleep with retainers.
It looks so good.
Why not? Thank you. But I wear the retainers now just during the day for a few hours.
Yep.
And I don't like to sleep with them.
Do you clench at night? Zero clenching, that's good. Because bruxism is another contributor to dry eye disease. This is if you remember from your anatomy, your masseter muscle is the only facial muscle that's innervated by your trigeminal nerve, right? Motor to the masseters. That's the only motor group there.
I'll pretend like I remember that, sure. Okay.
So it turns out that overaction of the masseter muscles creates excess neural tone, and that contributes to decreased tear production. So we're finding that if we treat it with a little bit of Botox right at the base of the masseter muscle, you turn down the volume on that trigeminal nerve dysfunction.
Oh, so interesting.
And that helps the dry eye patient. Their tear production improves.
That is so wild.
It's so cool.
Well, you have become like, when people ask, who's the expert on ocular surface? They're like, I got one person for you. LP. That's what you need, LP. Wow, this is so much. You're into this like I'm into cataract surgery.
Yeah, it's my passion. It's all I think about. Maybe that makes me an idiot savant. I don't know. But
you need to make Ocular Service, you know, coach.com or something. Come on, run with it.
I don't think my audience is ever going to get as big as yours.
Now, here, before we end this, we got only 5-10 minutes left. Give some straight advice. So a lot of my viewers, my listeners, they love just cataract surgery. We love surgery.
Yes, like, I do too. I miss it.
Don't tell everyone, but I do surgery for free. It's that much fun.
Yeah, it is super fun.
Yeah. So what's the kind of, give me a few pros to take home for a young ophthalmologist, 30s, 40s, maybe even 50 plus like me, who loves cataract surgery, knows a little bit about ocular service, but really wants to just optimize patients to have the best surgical outcome. What do I do to screen them ahead of time?
Yep.
How do I make sure that it's optimized enough? When do I know it's good to do surgery? And how do I handle any like post-op issues of like, the surgery looks beautiful, but now the ocular service is ugly?
Right. Didn't see it beforehand. I would say Cliff Notes version.
Yes.
You've got a nice crib sheet in the Ascaris updated preoperative dry treatment algorithm. Okay. It's a beautiful body of work. They did such a good job. So you can use that to as your crib notes, as your cliff notes, but it really boils down to look, lift, push, pull, okay. Treat inflammation. We talked about the speed of onset of your immunomodulators, treat the evaporative load problem. You've got a great tool for that in perfluorohexyloctane. Address any Demodex blepharitis. That is low hanging fruit, my friend. Mm. Like it is easy to pick off those 8-legged little micro pests on the ocular surface with 6 weeks of lotilaner treatment. Those are the easy buttons. Your lubricants do have a role, and I do recommend that you use them, but don't stop there. Make sure you're not missing anterior basement membrane dystrophy. Clean it up beforehand, right? Scrape it off, slap an amniotic membrane on there, promote good healing, then recheck your measurements. But I think those are kind of the simplest cliff notes. Your conservation, I'm really liking the intracanalicular gel lacquer fill system for conserving tears. We know that that's helpful in post-refractive patients. Years ago, there's a paper published where they put just a whisker of Botox right over the lacrimal sac to decrease tear clearance, and it helped a LASIK patient's dry eye and symptom indices after surgery. So that concept of tear conservation, I think, is a good one. And I think the lacquer fill is a far better mousetrap than punctal plugs. So those are the simplest things you can do. And I think if you just incorporate those things and have a lower threshold for prescribing immunomodulators and XDEMVY and perfluorohexyloctane, that you'll do a solid B job with ocular surface disease.
Right.
Solid B. Don't forget about your lid hygiene. That's easy to do. But don't waste your breath on warm compresses. It's not a high yield thing for the ocular surface. Those other things are high yield.
Got it. And then for post-op, beautiful surgical result, but you know now the tear film's kind of a little bit not so good.
Mm-hmm.
How do I buff those patients up in the post-op period?
So same strategy, look, lift, push, pull. Is there something you missed before? We know that collarettes almost double after cataract surgery, probably because of the steroids we use, right? Okay. The steroids you need to promote good healing also right. Encourage the population of growth of Demodex, right? So again, reach for your tools, reach for your immunomodulators, reach for your tear film stabilizers, reach for your anti-Demodex treatments. And then you can start looking at things like CCH and those other issues.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a very kind of thorough way of doing things.
I also simplified, and I hope that makes it more approachable for our colleagues and friends, right? Because I'm sure it feels overwhelming. There's so many innovations. It's like, gosh, when do I use what?
It is super overwhelming. Let me tell you.
Super overwhelming. So if you go back to a systems-based approach, what do I got for inflammation? What do I got for Demodex? What do I got for evaporation? That simplified approach. How's the cornea surface doing? Do I need to do a superficial K and an amniotic membrane? I think you can do a really good job without the overwhelm. And I think it dovetails quickly and nicely into a busy surgical office.
I think it's a lot of sense. I thank you for that. I really appreciate that. That makes a lot of sense. I like it simplified like that because I'm never going to have your deep, deep expertise in this.
And I'm not going to have yours.
My expertise is
we have each other.
You know, honestly, that's probably the best thing. Everyone finds their own happiness, right?
Exactly.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you. We've been talking, I can't believe it, for an hour already. Time flies.
That's really been. That's amazing. We didn't even get to talk about makeup. Oh my gosh. Maybe another time.
Let's briefly talk about that because the amount of makeup people wear
in
Los Angeles, mostly women, but also some men.
Yeah, I don't judge.
Blows my mind.
Yes.
Like I appreciate you want to look good for me on the day of surgery, but could you not put on the fake lashes and the eyeliner on the day of surgery? Hello?
Yeah, I think it's just habit, right? You don't feel awake until you've got your mascara on. That's just a thing.
I don't know. I wake up looking like this. What am I going to tell you? I don't know.
Naturally beautiful like your sister.
Yeah, I don't know. I get the long eyelashes, but the long eyelashes go with like the back hair, so I'm not sure you want it.
Well, the good with the bad. It's all good. So I think hopefully coming soon, I've been working really, really hard on a customized, designed from scratch formulation to help our colleagues make good cosmetic recommendations for their patients.
Oh, cool.
We've got a mascara that's, I formulated it from the ground zero. I've been working on it for 9 years.
Wow.
A preservative-free makeup remover that really works well without irritating the eye. And we have an eyelid, what we're calling the eyelid defender serum, which depuffs, reduces redness in the lids, reduces telangiectasias, forms a protective barrier against the environmental stresses of the day, pollutants, reactive oxygen species, all these sorts of things. So, and that's universal for men and for women. There's no pigment to it. Layers beautifully under sunscreen, makeup, whatever you got. And yeah, we're coming to market with that this year.
That sounds pretty cool. I'm your worst patient though, because I don't ever wear sunscreen because I figure I'm brown. I don't need sunscreen. And then I just wash my face with the same bar of Dial soap or Irish Spring soap that I use on my body. And that's all
and
I need.
And you don't need mascara, but you might like my Defender Serum.
You know,
next time I see you, we'll try some on you. One eye. We're gonna make the other eye jealous.
I'll volunteer for the trial. That sounds amazing. Well, I love to hear your passion. You're so passionate about this, which is really such a pleasure to talk to you. Really is.
Thank you, my friend. This was delightful. I appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. So we'll put all your links down below. Whatever links you send me, we'll put down here. I think you're an incredible resource. Certainly, if you have a meeting coming up and you want an incredible speaker, but everything ocular surface, LP is your doctor.
Thank
no question
you.
About it.
Amazing.
Well, again, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Reminder, listeners and viewers, remember, get a new Cataract Coach podcast every single Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find a podcast. You find the number one podcast in all of ophthalmology, the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, we now have our sister channel, Retinurons, and we have a Retinurons podcast as well. Check it out. And by the time you're hearing this, we'll be on video number 3,000. New video every day, 3,000 days in a row. That's cataractcoach.com. So until next time, I'll catch you later.